If you're celebrating a fundraise, you're in the wrong game, mate. You just bought yourself some pain, and now you got to do shit. You celebrate a customer. You only celebrate customers.
Hey, how are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Ray Nolan, an Irish entrepreneurial legend. He's arguably one of Ireland's most successful entrepreneurs and investor, which is little known outside the community. He built Hostel World to $500 million exit and then went on to become the chairman of Skyscanner and is now building eDesk, which, from chatting to Ray today, this could be the biggest one of all. This is my chat with Ray Nolan. Today's episode is presented in association with Square. Over 4 million companies, from local shops to international chains, use Square to take payments, manage staff, and do business in-store and online. For almost everything your business needs, visit square.com. Square International Limited Trading as Square is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. I've got a massive ambition for this podcast. I want to make this the number one business podcast in the world. If I'm going to do that, I've got to be world-class on every single level. And that includes having a world-class studio, which I now have at iconic offices, The Green Room. It's an incredible space. I first recorded here with my live pod back in June, and I loved it. And get this, it's publicly bookable. That means you can go online and book it right now. As I said, it's called The Green Room. It's a private cinema and screening room. That means it's perfect to wow a client with a pitch, host a private screening, or do what I do, record a podcast here. So, as I record here, and as you know, I'm a member of Iconic Offices, I've got the team at Iconic Offices to hook us up with a number of exclusive complimentary office trials and discounts for my audience for booking this exact space. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description, grab the offer that works best for you. Thanks, Iconic Offices. The Wealth Summit is on the RDS on November 15th. It's for entrepreneurs, business owners, and those that aspire to be. If you're at the startup, scale-up, or sell-up stage of the entrepreneurial journey, then the Wealth Summit is for you. Learn how to build personal and business balance sheets through business growth strategies and build out critical paths to financial independence. Join Stephen Bartlett, Niall Quinn, Mandy Hickson, Tom Gannon, and 30 other speakers for a day of empowerment, motivation, education, growth, and networking. And we have an exclusive offer for listeners of the pod. For €150 plus VAT, you're going to get a discounted Access All Areas ticket, which also gives you access to the Wealth Tribe lunch, and it gives you a free masterclass on November 16th on how you can actually implement AI into your business. So click the link below to avail of this incredible offer. Ray, welcome to the pod.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
Genuine pleasure to have you on. You're a shining light, I would say, in the Irish entrepreneurial scene. You're someone I've had on my radar for a long time. A lot of people have requested this one, so no pressure.
Well, I hope I live up to the expectation. I doubt I will, but there you go. Let's see how we get on.
I was reading through your LinkedIn last night, and it was one of those ones where I'm not even sure where to start with, Ray. So we'll start at the start. You're a self-taught programmer.
Yeah, still, one of my greatest passions is writing software, although I don't get to do it anymore, but huge fan of it. It's great satisfaction, great sense of achievement when you write something and you see it on a screen and you see millions of people using it or whatever. It's still it's an awesome thing to do. So, yeah, self-taught. I was useless in college, hated every minute of it. Didn't really attend, actually. Spent a long time there, though.
What did you do?
Time as a registered student. I did electrical/electronic engineering in Kevin Street.
Okay.
Didn't finish.
Didn't vibe with you, or why not?
I went to college when I was 16. I didn't want to leave when I was 16, not because I was bright, just because I was fucked out the door when I was 3 to school, I guess. so probably too young. I mean, if you think about that world, I mean, it's almost like it's a crazy world, but you think that someone who's 16 is doing their leaving. That means they've made their decision on what their leaving cert subjects will be when they're 14 or 13.
Yeah, 13, yeah.
And therefore decided somewhat the direction they're heading in. And then when you're even at sort of CAO time, you're 15 and someone says, you know, you're kind of okay at maths. Why don't you be an engineer? And I'm going, well, can I just get lollipops and scale extric, you know? And instead I go into engineering. I have no clue what it's about. Still, 6 years in college later, wouldn't trust a plug that I wired. So that gives you a sense of my knowledge of electricity.
But yet you're a coder. How does that work? Like, how
coding
does
has nothing to do with engineering. Coding is a joy. I mean, you could call it educated typing. You could call it delivering logic onto a page or onto a screen. It's not engineering in the sort of classic engineering mode of things, which is about specification, millimeters, and all this kind of stuff. It's almost like freeform art for me.
Really?
Writing code and building software.
You said the stereotypical coder image is completely wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a bit dated in this world, in case you haven't worked it out. PCs were barely there when I joined the alleged workforce. But, you know, the stereotype is super brainy maths guy, importantly, in the stereotypical world, basically brought about before my time, which was the lads who did the punch cards. It was like a shop floor. We got to keep people out of this industry. So we got to make people think we're really clever. So we're going to keep people out.
Okay.
We get paid a lot of money to stack cards and put them in a tray. And so I rail against that completely. I think it's a super creative environment. I wish that this BS wasn't all pervasive. I think everybody,
it's very strong. You're the first person, and we've done 300 episodes, you're the first person to say this.
That coding is for geniuses, not for geniuses?
There's definitely that.
Oh, stop.
Well, you know, the butcher is going to tell you his meat tastes good. You know what I mean? If you're a coder, you're not going to say, oh, look, sure, look, it's grand.
Well, I think it's something that everybody should have a go at. You'd be surprised the people who thought they would have no talent for it or no scope to achieve things in the software industry, period, but more so as a coder.
So how did you find your way then? Because college obviously wasn't for you. You know, how did you find your way into coding going, yeah, look, this is going to be for me. I'm going to make my own way.
Well, I wrote a computer game. I wrote, might say something about it. I see gambling came up today. I wrote Draw Poker on a Sinclair Spectrum in part BASIC and part Z80 assembler, which would be a pretty toughish language to get shit done in. And sold it, made some money, not a whole lot of money, but made money. And
what age were you?
I was 16 or 17, maybe 17. It's 82. Yeah, 17. So, yeah, then went, never really had a job, just got a couple of contracts based on what I had sort of self-taught myself. Then hired a few people myself when I was about 21, I guess. I had a few coders, 22 maybe. And we started writing bespoke software, just one-off jobs for everybody who wanted something done.
What kind of stuff?
Database. Anything. Could be a membership system for the Alzheimer's Society. I remember that. We did a training system for the Irish Times. We did a bank reconciliation system for when the banks were famously not applying the right interest rates to people way back in the day. Yeah, anything, meat companies, you name it, I've written software. And that's beautiful too. It's a bit like, imagine being exposed to how everybody makes money.
Mm.
You know, so you're in a world where you think, oh, well, you know, raise travel or ways, whatever. But no, I come from, most of the stuff that I apply today, I got from watching a meat company make money. Or, you know, watching the efficiencies and watching where things go wrong in those industries and writing software to try and make those things go away. So it's a bit like being a consultant in a sort of business consultancy kind of, remember they used to be, I used to call them management consultants, but they were management consultants, allegedly. And, you know, where you get to see how other people make money and apply it. So in a software business, you not only have to see it, apply it, you got to fix it. And I would have, my greatest days were going into a business that's looking for one thing and saying, yeah, but you're not really looking at it the right way. You realize that most of the losses are over here and I can fix that too in like with a little bit extra, you know. So
you were getting a double insight. You were teaching yourself how to run a business by watching everybody else make the mistakes.
Well, I'm not sure I was ever taught how to run a business. I was taught how, I've learned how to make money. I've never had a boss, right? So that's a bit tedious. I've never been on a management course per se, so I'm probably the worst manager in the world. And so I lack some of the rounded edges that maybe other people would have gotten over time because they would have seen things. But maybe I've rounded over time. But I was seeing how other people make money. But basically, I was just hustling to pay my pay the bills, right? I was writing software. I wasn't like, I had a grand vision. It was like, I need to make money. I can write software. Let's see how much software we can write and get through the day.
And what was next? You made a comment to me over our coffee about selling time. You were selling
time. Yeah, well, if you're selling time, obviously you can only sell 24 hours unless you're a lawyer. And I wrote a system. All the barristers in Ireland still use software that I wrote in 1991. Imagine. That's 33 years ago. That I wrote myself. But interestingly, why I say lawyers are the only people who can charge more than 24 hours in a day is you're charging billable units. That's not barristers, more so solicitors or American lawyers, where you're charging on the clock. So I can get 10 calls done in an hour, but each of those calls has a minimum unit of 15 minutes. So effectively, I've charged 2 hours in my 2 hours.
And they're still using that software.
Yeah, they still are, which is good. Good, it's still working.
Good for you. Great for efficiency.
I don't own the company anymore. I sold it to Sage way back when. But yes. But selling time is, you know, unless you get to the outer echelons of what people charge for stuff. If you're $1,000 an hour, top in Ireland lawyer, good on you. But for most of us, we're not going to get that.
At what point did you realize that? What point did you go, nah, not doing this anymore?
It almost sounds like they would put in a plan if I answered that. In fairness, someone came to me once and said, I need a piece of software to do X. And I go, well, the number, it's going to cost you 50 grand. And he goes, I don't have 50 grand. And I go, what about if you get 10 of your buddies to give 5 grand? Now we got a product. And then the real nice piece, and this was the barristers, actually, interestingly enough, in 91. I said, why don't you get 10 of your buddies to give 5 grand? And every time I sell a piece of the software, I'll give them some money back until they get all their money back. And then it's mine. And so we gave them whatever it was. They all got their money back and that was fine. So what's the thing that happens here? First of all, I'm financed to write the software, so I get paid, which is kind of cool. Next is I get left with a piece of software when they get their bit. And I was giving them maybe 30% of what I was getting every time we sold a copy thereafter. Mm. But better again, and this is, I call it customer financing. It's probably moved on to a kind of a sassy kind of world now, like in terms of annual payments and so on. But the beauty was every one of those 10 barristers found a friend that wanted it because they knew that only if this thing became popular would they get their money back.
So you were the first ever affiliate scheme. Yeah, now everyone's doing it.
Even if it was shit, they were going to tell everybody it was great because they wanted their money back, right? So... And it was good, so it was fine.
That's a juicy little business model you cooked up very first out of the gates.
Yeah, and use it again a few times in different products that we did, because I never really had a lot of money until maybe Hustleware became something big. We did it again with time and billing software. I wrote CoreTime.com. What was originally pre-internet was CoreTime, and it became CoreTime.com, which we sold to Sage. It was time and billing software. Again, someone comes with an idea, and I go, I can do this, and I can do it way better. But it's going to cost you a lot more. Find me some people that will use it. And they will go out and recruit people. And did it with the hostels. Did it with the hostels again when Hostel World came out. And it's a decent model because it's a win-win. If Hostel World became successful, then the hostels who paid me in advance with the hostels, the bigger one, which have been hostels, we had lots of hostels. They were using our software. It's a desktop piece of software. And
was this the same story again? Someone came to you, needs some software to run a hostel. How did that work?
No, how Hostelware came about is bizarre. I don't know what happened. I got into telephone cost management, would you believe, which is PABXs have an output port on the back of them that prints a line of print every time the phone is put down.
Right.
So in a hotel, you would have seen a little line printer every time a room put down a phone. It would say extension 25, dial 0044, blah, 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 for 16 minutes. And somebody would work out what that cost was. And they were in offices too. And wow. Aircom, interestingly, brought out, they moved from a world where every call was charged to every 3 minutes on a call was charged.
Okay.
It's a long time ago. So telephone cost management became a thing. So anyway, we put this into places and offices mostly, and then some hotels, some smaller hotels. And then one of the hotels said, well, you know, you've got all the room number and that shit. Why don't you tell me who's in the room? And then help me book the room. So we wrote a hotel system, which was very, very light in terms of functionality. But it worked. You could book a hotel only on the desktop, off the phone and so on.
Yeah.
And then one of those hotels had a hostel and said, can we get it for the hostel? And I said, nah, this is never going to work in a hostel. Because in hostels, we have rooms with 20 beds or 10 beds. Yeah, and they're all checking out on different days.
Complexity goes
through
the roof.
And there's boy rooms and girl rooms. And there's mixed rooms. And there's private rooms. So it's all a bit of a haze. So I said, look, I'm going to write a specific hostel product. And then at that time, we raised... some other hostels pitched in to say, well, yeah, we want one too. So they paid and then we...
So you did the same model again, back to the same model.
And then when the web came out, I did exactly the same. I went to the hostels and I said, we want 10%. It'll be 10% commission on everything you sell. But I don't have the money to write it, so you better... So if you give me 50 grand, I'll give you 100 grand worth of bookings.
Right.
AKA a million quid's worth of commission-free bookings. And I think 10 or so hostels got involved, and that was enough to connect the desktop product to the web and get that whole thing working.
Where does that confidence come from? Is it because you know you're going to deliver a superb product?
I'm a bit obsessive. I don't really deliver shit ever. It's really, really good. Not confidence, but it's not belligerent either. I know what I'm doing, right? So if I say I'm going to do it, I've got a vision of the pictures of the screens in my head, and I can sketch them and, you know, bring them to life. Even if it's just a PowerPoint, I can bring it to life and you'll get the idea. And in theory, if you believe I'm going to get it done, then it's a great deal. Because don't forget, I mean, the hostel business, the hostel world was an insane business for all the hostels, not just for hostel world. Because what they were doing was they were getting, when the web came out, you had a hostel going, you know, they build their website. I've got a cousin who built me a website. And then they get email, have you got space on the 25th of December or the Paddy's Day or whatever? And the problem was that everybody who had email was mailing all the hostels for the same day. So they're all putting a dollar's worth of effort into a booking that might have grossed 10 bucks.
Yeah.
And so when we connected that to the system that had the information, they weren't doing any work. They were getting bookings. We were marketing their product. We had all the best sites and so on. So it was a great model, and it was very fair in the context of we were not only providing them with business, we're providing them with software that ran their business. So we're doing the check-in, the check-out, what rooms need to be cleaned.
Really? So you built in all that functionality?
Yeah, it was already in, it was already in the desktop product, and we ported it then to the web product. So.
Okay. I think to give people a scale of how successful that was, or again, referring back to your LinkedIn, $500 million exit on 120K invested.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty cool. And we didn't raise any money ever, really. The 100K was incidental in things. We sold a lot of stock on the way, but to keep our own pockets lined, if you like. But it was a great ride. It was worth north of a billion once. It's not worth anything like that now. It is public. But when we went to IPO in around 2008, the markets really went tits up because of the whole thing that we had to pull the IPO. And then I got out, I think December 2009, I think I got out. Because someone said we'd have the biggest exit of the decade. And I thought, that's attractive. I love that. So we did.
You like that headline, right?
Trophies.
I like that. How did it go, right? How does it go to go from 120K invested or incidental amount invested to 500 million? Because like, talk me through, obviously you had perfect product market fit, you had a win-win business model. How does that scale?
Well, the business model was insane. I mean, when I'm starting this, sitting on my own, looking at the internet going, I've got to make this work somehow. And we're a small company, we've no money. So the idea of going to a hostel going, I need to book your hostel, so will you give me credit? So I'll take the bookings and I'll pay you when the guest stays. Mm. They're going, who are you? You're some fucking guy I've never heard of before, and you're in Colombia, and you think I'm going to let your guest stay in my hostel for free, and someday you're going to pay me? So it was pretty horrendous. And also the commission levels, like at 10%, we're taking 10% on a typically $15 room.
Mm.
It's just $150 if you stay one night, right? So even processing $150 for these people, you couldn't afford the stamp to send them the money if you were going to post a check, right? So the beauty of Hostelworld, not only was the product, which was insane, but the business model was outrageous, which is, I'll never owe you money. So I walk into you and I go, I'm going to give you software that's going to make you massively efficient, going to change your business in terms of running the beds and who's cleaning and who's coming and who's going and all that kind of stuff. I'm going to sell your rooms. I'm going to charge you 10%, and I'm never going to owe you money, because we take the 10% at point of booking, and you get the 90% when the guest walks in the door. Mm-hmm. So there'll be no chasing money around the world going, where's my dollars? You get paid when you're supposed to be paid, and we get paid when we're supposed to be paid. And that was outrageous. It's become a model that is around the world now, but we were first. We were first with that model. And that means, so hit me with your objections when I come to sell you this thing, because I'm not selling it to you. I'm giving you like software that we, previous to Hostelworld, would have sold for 10, 15, 20 grand a copy.
I think that's important, to give that context, because everyone's familiar with SaaS now, right? Oh, pay $9.99 a month and off you go. Back in the day, you would have had to outlay 20, 30, 40, 50 grand for software.
And you would have paid maintenance of 12 or 15% or whatever it is every year.
That's key for people who might know the context of what software was like back then.
Yeah, so we're taking a huge headache. They would have come from a world where they used paper diaries to do their bookings, like big, huge ledger-type paper diaries, or a spreadsheet if they were really advanced, to a world where they could see graphically how full their hostel were.
So how do you scale all those 150s to become worth north of a billion?
Well, you book a whole lot of beds, basically. You know, we were doing, I can't remember. We were certainly doing 3,000 and 4,000 bookings a day, growing. Like, I remember we would, when it started to really, really motor, we'd celebrate milestones, like lots of milestones. So we'd celebrate 100 bookings in a day. Mm-hmm. Then we'd celebrate 200 bookings in a day. And we'd be like, I was a bit younger then, but I'm still prone to a few jars, but we would have gone on that rip, like, you know, just, it was fantastic. But there were times that we'd plan the 500 party for Friday and we'd hit 700 by Friday. Mm-hmm. And so it just got outrageous because it was, the market wanted it. And we were a monopoly. You know, we were first out. We had the best software. We had 5 years of running hostels on desktop software before. So anyone wanted to play catch up had a lot to do. And meanwhile, all the guys with all the money were doing hotels, because there's a lot more money in hotel bookings. And so we let them fight for the top and we were just running around.
How did you aggressively scale it, though? Was it just perfect market, perfect timing, or how did you actually get it? How did you make Pete Costles aware?
Oh, we'd hit cities, like physically. We would arrive in a city and we'd pick the 3 or 4 biggest hostels. And once you got them, the others fell in line because they knew these guys going to eat everybody's lunch. Mm. So, and again, it's a no-brainer to sign up, you know.
I reached out to a few people before you're coming on and I asked them, what should I talk to Ray about? And someone he said, he's the best product guy I've ever met. When I met him and showed him my product, he was able to ask me questions I'd never even thought about.
Yeah. That's quite a compliment. I am pretty good at product. Product people didn't exist. So you were everything. I mean, software, the days when, you know, when I started writing software, you were everything. You were the product guy, you were the UI guy, you were the designer, you were the coder, you were the debugger, you were the everything. You did it and you delivered it. And so that was very, very special to have that experience. Now it's, I mean, how many people? We got UI, UX, designers, coders, testers, product, you know. So it's that's a bit, you know, you go, well, who gets to celebrate the release then? It becomes drudgery. It's just a machine. You're on a treadmill to deliver software. It's very important to celebrate when you push something out there. And it's also very important to look back and go, who was involved? And not to let Ray or Ramon or Ramona not participate in the party that says that was pretty darn good, you know, because you've basically just produced a Gauguin. And it's a joy. And when I hark back, I mentioned the Alzheimer's. I don't know why it was sprung to mind. My old man died of Alzheimer's, I suppose. But we did a way back. One of my first ever paid jobs was the Alzheimer's Society. I think they might still be out, John of God's. And it was to just do their mailing list. There were two ladies. I can't remember the names for the life of me. I can remember one, but we disserviced the other one if I remember. So, and they typed on in triplicate on carbon-backed paper. They typed labels and letters to their database of 1,000 people, wow, begging letters effectively, yeah, every month or whatever. Their newsletter, they're asking for money thing. And I remember putting a little database together for them so they could segment it like on a PC and giving them their first piece, well, getting them their first PCs. And then we press the button and I print all the labels and just watch them gasp and go, that's like 3 hours or 3 days of my month or a day of my week gone that you just did that. And then ironically, and these ladies were in their 60s. I say, that's old, I'm getting close to it. They wrote macros in WordPerfect that would shame many of the programmers I've worked with. Like, just to get shit that we hadn't written into the database software. They were that, you know, they just grasped it. And when you, like, think of the joy from me. I've just delivered something. I see eyes light up. And when you get that eyes light up moment, it's,
I think that's the magic of technology. Like, there's this awful narrative.
It came with so much promise and then delivered shit. I mean, you know, think about email. It was the future of solving everything. Mm. I mean, how many minutes do you spend killing spam every morning?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't seem to be on the butt end of it at the moment, but, you know, it didn't help. And you got people doing ass covering and CCing the world. I mean, if you CC me on a mail, you better be fucking sure it means something to me, that you're not just doing it because you want to be seen to be great. If you're writing to Johnny and you want Johnny to get something, you CC me, there better be a reason. Because if it looks to me like you're trying to leverage something here, you're going to get it between the eyes. You know, that's
human nature, isn't it? Nature is destroying the technology advances we're making. If you look at AI, we'll definitely get onto AI shortly. You know, people, the narrative is, it's going to take our jobs. Like, that's so backward to think like that. When you, and that's why the example is in my head. When you mentioned those two ladies there, it's not like they were suddenly shown the road. They were given this tool to make them better and more efficient. Yeah, that's what technology should be.
And it should be an enabler in terms of get the drudgery out of the way and let's do the smart stuff that we enjoy. Why would you want to do the crap when there's so much stuff that you can explore and people's potential to do other great stuff and not have them just rubber stamp stuff, you know? So
when you left Hostel World, number one, why did you leave? Why did you decide to sell? I know you said
we were teed up for an IPO. We had gone on the road looking for a CEO who pulled at the last minute. The IPO was pulled at the last minute too. I was never going through the door of the IPO. I was nearly 9 years in the business at that stage. Started it in March 99. Literally myself and a programmer, like a web guy who was able to help me connect the existing software to the web. Mm. And I had done 9 years and I said, look, I will do the IPO because it seems a good thing to do. But I'm not going through the door because you can't really, if you're going to do an IPO, you've got to be there for 5 years. You got to commit. And I,
when you say you're not going through the door, you just ran out of energy, ran out of time, ran out of interest.
I've been lying. I mean, I've been lying. I can't lie to be, you know, I have to be true to myself, which is, you know, I have arguably all the money in the world. I'm going to have arguably another, whatever it is, number. And I'm not the guy to tread the boards anymore. I won't do it well. I won't exhibit the hunger that is needed.
Why not?
So I just felt in that industry, you know, it's very hard to sit at a table beside someone who's got a modest business and them know that I'm going to use the word titan, but I can't think of a different word, right? So you've got someone who's got a $1 billion business talking to someone who runs a nice little mom and pop, you know, hostel with 20 beds, and you're trying to get them across the line. And the imbalance of, you know, there's no enterprise sale in hostels, you know, that would have said, okay, now I can move from selling to mom and pop. Although there were several, and we changed the entire hostel industry and brought in players with 400, 500 beds, which was fantastic. Change in industry, hopefully for the better, absolutely, certainly for the better. But it wouldn't have been me. I wouldn't have been able to represent very well. And I wasn't spending 5 more years doing it. I can do other things. I mean, you know, if you think about before that, I had done all these other kinds of software from abattoirs to whatever. To spend that much time in travel was quite a long time for me.
So what was the vision? What was Ray thinking back then? This is what I'm going to do. Did you have a plan?
No, I never have a plan. Jesus, no. In terms of what's happening next, I have loose thoughts and I kind of happen into things.
So what did you do? You walked away.
Yeah, I walked away. I had, it was the recession. I think I had probably the best idea I ever had in terms of what we would do, which was worky.com, which I still argue was one of the best ideas, but we did launch it into the greatest recession that ever happened. And
what was Worky?
It was kind of LinkedIn for ordinary people, if I can say that. LinkedIn without the need for a network. So, I mean, it's okay. You and I can pretend we're all very clever and we're all LinkedIn and we're all getting our network and so on. But if I'm a barman and I want to represent, I want to have a page about me and I want to see jobs for me and I want that thing, we did some stuff in Worky.com that was outrageous. Still hasn't been done. We did like geofencing. So you could say, an employer could say, I need a barman who lives within 10 miles of here. And it would show you the 10 barman.
Was it Worky what you did next after Hostel World?
Yeah, well, I was also chairman of the Skyscanner at the time, which we took from 30 million to about 1.6 billion.
Oh, yeah. Just throw that in there. Yeah. Just chairman.
So Worky wasn't a full time job. It was kind of like a pet project that we just kept throwing new cool ideas at. Eventually shut it down. Well, might be still there, actually, but nobody works there.
How did the Skyscanner job come about? So you're chairman of Skyscanner?
Yeah, we had tried to buy it in Hostelworld days. And I thought we got the deal done, but we were very close and we didn't, for pretty small money, in fairness. And then when I got out of Hostelworld, they asked me to be chairman. And there was a bit of fighting going on. People weren't getting on with the VC that was there. So I was brought in to sell it for 30 million.
What does the chairman do? Like, what's the chairman's job?
Well, have you got an hour?
That's something I always wondered. I was like, chairman, well, sounds cool.
You know, you're the interface between the shareholders and the board and the CEO. I mean, ostensibly a NED should never really talk to, a non-exec director should not talk to the CEO directly. They should come through the chairman.
Okay.
But you're kind of a mentor to the CEO and to the management team in some cases. And because I was so ingrained in online travel, I was there a lot. You know, I was there for probably 3-4 days a month in Edinburgh. But I mean, the interesting there was really that we had three co-founders who were fighting with the VC, all of whom had decided, right, that's enough, let's get out of here. They'd all made it tickle. And they said, come in and sell it for us. And it was in my contract to sell it. And I had a year to sell it for 30 million. Everybody said, this is great. And then the first time we went to the first board meeting, they said, no, we want to go now. I go, oh, thanks for that, lads. You could have let me learn a little bit more about the business. Mm. And so, I don't know. I just took the lads aside separately. They were singing with one voice that we want to go, not the VC who would have stayed or gone. They were, you know, it was tedious for them. And I just worked a little bit of, well, it turns out he doesn't want to go now. He's a real believer. This other guy wants to go now. And this other guy wants to stay forever.
Right.
And so I basically built...
Did you sense that?
Yeah. Kind of... This was all over beers and dinners, you know, which was to try and get... And so, interestingly, I built a world where I got the lads to commit. One guy to stay for a year, one guy to stay for 2 to 3 years, and one guy to stay forever. And got the VCs on board to say, well, this is how it's going to be. And it was just... a catalyst, you know, just an ordinary guy having meetings about that kind of stuff. There was nothing, you know, grand vision, except I said, this is to get, let this go for 30 million is a disaster, you know. So interestingly, the first guy out probably got 70 million. And then some people got 150.
It's a serious sight, like.
Yeah. So, you know, everybody did very well. But it was brilliant. I mean, the CEO was brilliant. I mean,
how long did you do that for?
3 years to the day. I did, the last thing I did was sell 10% of the company to Sequoia for 80 million. Like sell, not get investment. They bought. Nice. And then a year and a half later, we sold the whole thing for 1.6 billion.
Okay.
Which was good. Yeah.
What drives you, Ray?
I like making things. I like working with nice people. I like making things. That's pretty cool. And it's nice to see people deliver on their promise, you know, particularly young people where they come in a bit raw and they've got sort of rabbit in the headlights look, and you see them settle and you see them, you know, I like to take people from, let's say, lower in the organization, whatever it is, and give them a shot at the title and say, you know, accelerate them through because they clearly want it. And I'm okay with breaking things. You know, I always think, you know, people obsess about decisions. Indecision is far worse than no decision. I always say a bad decision is better than no decision. Yeah. So we can procrastinate about this for 6 months, or you can do it today and we know it's a disaster in a month's time. I'm all for that. We'll have learnt and we move on. And so, you know, that kind of approach has stood okay to me. But what would I do if I wasn't doing this? I don't even know.
You were never tempted just to go, job done.
Well, I have to say now is probably as challenged. Well, now or recently has been as challenged as I've been in terms of trying to fix what became a broken company or slightly broken in terms of the how it was run in eDesk. That's been probably one of the hardest challenges. But no, I wouldn't give up. No. It's
Do you love it or do you need it?
Oh, I don't need it. I don't need anything. I mean, that's, you know, it's funny, people kind of be careful what you wish for in the entrepreneurial world. You know, the money is kind of incidental, pretty much always has been, genuinely always has been. I eat one dinner, I drink maybe more pints than I should and maybe more than some other people, but it's not a hugely expensive lifestyle. Mm. You know, you don't have to. I mean, you've got a roof. I do spend some money, but I mean, you don't need it. So you do it because...
Does that change beyond a certain point? Because you do hear that quite a bit. Is it beyond a certain point, or was it just never something that really concerned you?
I don't know if it ever changed. I think I've always been good at hustling. So even when I had nothing, I remember, you know, my very early software company getting to a Friday when you pay people weekly and not having the payroll and having to find it somehow. You know, that they're pretty tedious days. But mostly I've been okay. So I go into business for profit. I'm not like, so a lot of SaaS companies particularly, you know, it's just a burning machine and they don't really have a vision of profit. They go, oh, we'll build it. It's not build it and they'll come, it's build it. We'll keep growing. We'll keep spending money on growth. We'll keep. And guess what? So a day comes like now, maybe a few months ago more so, and suddenly now we're not accepting that you're spending 6 years revenue to acquire a customer that will probably leave after three. Mm-hmm. You know, and so a lot of those companies are being found out.
Where does that mentality come from? Because it's so pervasive.
I don't know. It's a bit, the startup ecosystem, you know, frankly, you can kind of have it. You know, you mentioned MVP and product market fit, all those fucking jibe terms. You know, if you're celebrating a fundraise, you're in the wrong game, mate. Because, you know, that's just, you just bought yourself some pain and now you got to do shit. You celebrate a customer. You only celebrate customers. And so, yeah, fundraiser, get something out of the way if you need to. I've never actually really raised funds per se, except to sell the dream that this software that I'm building will ever get built. You know.
Why is that though, Ray? Like that is the most logical, and we talk about that a lot on this pod. I think there's this fetishization of like, oh, they've raised 10 million, they've raised 50 million. That's seen as the thing. And for a lot of entrepreneurs, oh yeah, that's the goal. And I always ask people, what's the goal? And if they go raise 10 million, I'm like, oof, that's the first goal you've said to me.
Yeah. And even if the goal is money, maybe that's the wrong thing too. If you want to change the world, or you want to make something that was really difficult, easy. That evidence is something in someone that's a lot different to someone saying, I want to be a millionaire. You know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs or grantrepreneurs out there, you know.
Grantrepreneurs. I actually haven't heard that. And that is absolutely on the money.
Yeah. Like, you know, I'll keep going to, I mean, it's this is a hard thing to do and it's not for everybody. And just because, you know, I would love to do a better rendition of I Don't Like Mondays than I do and to be paid for doing it. But I'm not a great singer. And I don't have the talent and I never will. So why is it that somebody who's not a great singer in the sort of entrepreneur world feels that they should keep banging on? You can't. Some people, I think it's an art. I've expressed how I think development, software development is kind of an art. I think entrepreneurship cannot be really learned. You can get the nuances and you can get a sort of, there are CEOs out there perfectly positioned and great at what they do when a company is mature and you're basically running the machine really, really well. Those companies are few and far between, though. You have to have an entrepreneurial vibe. You cannot just run, you know, a SaaS company by reading all the great SaaS books and go, hey ho, you know, I know what to do now. I've seen it fail. I've hired 3 CEOs in my time, and they've all failed because they just felt it was in a book. And, you know, it's not in a book.
How do we make the startup ecosystem better? Because there is a lot of zombie companies out there. A lot of companies just surviving on grants, surviving on the next check from the government. How do we make it better?
I think you got to encourage more money back into the space. I've been, you know, I have to say I don't have the time, so I don't want to bring about all kinds of pain and suggest that I'm available to have meetings about investing in companies. I've done well, and I have invested in companies that did very well. Money has to be pushed back into the system. You got to encourage. So everybody who got out should be encouraged to get back in because they're not just bringing their money; they're bringing their knowledge and their thing. And you know, I don't think people realize who aren't in business, who aren't living on the smell of a wet rag, you know, that entrepreneurs tend to live on a quarter to a third of the salary they would get in the open market, and they do that for quite a period of time. And everyone goes, "Well, hey, look at this person. 5 years later, is worth millions," but they've lived on nothing. Yeah. And quite often, we're being forced to get out because there's debt and there's a family and there's a house that isn't rented or paid for or whatever. Yeah. And you kind of go, eventually, because of the way our tax system is structured, people feel they have to get out. And so people are getting out too early. And then they may not get back in. They just kind of go, well, cool, look at me, I made some money. I really believe that, you know, you've got a world where the Irish government is fundamentally, it's a bit cheeky.
Say it,
but
Ray.
It's a bunch of teachers who wanted longer holidays, right? That's what it comes out as. And so they don't know anything about entrepreneurship. It's the antithesis of entrepreneurship is what they're about. They may come from farming. They may come from a small town, you know, whatever, but they've never run a business and they don't know what running a business is, but they don't put their hand up and say, see, I know that I'm a shit singer. And if I wanted to sing better, I'd hire a singing coach.
Yeah.
They don't hire a singing coach. There is no, in the UK, they have entrepreneurs in the mix, as in there's a head of entrepreneurship in a country who they actually railroad stuff through, and they go past all the systems and say, this ain't going to work because this guy, if he doesn't get the
reality
today, you know, and so we've nothing like that. We have EI, which, you know, effectively, I mean, look, they're civil servants, right? I get it. They're in there, they do a job and they go home at night. IDA, different world, similar kind of vibe though, but, and they do great stuff. They bring people in, take all the developers that the local companies could use. So there's no ecosystem that brings up, you can't just start another, you know, incubator and say, well, hey, look at us, or throw another 50 million at startups. It needs more than that. It isn't just money. It's like, okay, make it worth their while, you know, and encourage people who've made it to put back in, and also let the people who are in take something out at maybe a better tax rate so they stay in. So instead of saying, I'm selling the whole thing, I'll find a way to get some money out, and that means I can get myself a house.
Exactly.
And that means I'm getting completely out. So, but they don't get it. I've spent time with some ministers, but frankly, it's like, we're personality-wise, we wouldn't be the same anyway. So.
I'm kind of getting that vibe, right? When have you done some angel investing? You talked about getting involved.
I'm probably the most successful. I don't mean to be, so I must be lucky. But I do judge character pretty well, and I've done. Where do I start? I mean, obviously Skyscanner. I put some money in. I did well. I did. I've had a piece of Ding. I've had Storyful, Kinzen, Soundwave, Robotify, OpenMac, probably. I think I would guess that I've had 20 exits, and I've had probably 5 go down or less than that. Some of the crazy ones went down that you would have thought would succeed. Crazy.
That's a high hit ratio.
Oh, it beats any, there's an IRR of over like 190% or something on all the investments. But it's mostly because I end up getting involved. That's why I can't invest right now, right? Because I'm the CEO and I don't have the time. And so I don't have the time to listen, to do any kind of diligence on it, or to get involved. And you know, what tends to happen is someone go and raise a load of money. It isn't going as well as it should. Who are we going to call? Even though he only owns 5 points of the business, all the other shareholders going, oh, great, we'll get Ray in. He'll do it. I go, you know what? I'm not working for you. You know what I mean? Why would I want to work your investment for you? So
out of the ones that have been successful, what have been the traits that you've looked for?
I invest with my gut. I mean, so the huge ones obviously would be Ding, run by an amazing guy. And in Mark Roden, who's just great friend, great guy. Learned so much from being close to him. Sky Scanner equally, so that you can count them out. But mostly good ideas and prepared to listen and worked really hard. There's not really ones that kind of, there were very few 1 and 2 year ones, you know, they were nearly always 5-6 years on the go. And I've really enjoyed working with the people that I don't do kind of blind investing. I couldn't be arsed. You know what I mean? Just throw money into something and hope a check comes back. It's not really my vibe.
You talked about eDesk briefly. Let's dig into that. Mm-hmm. How did that start?
How did it start? Well, I was probably more available than I am now post Hostelworld, and I looked around at some stuff, and one of my friends had a business selling stuff online, and he showed me around, and it was very hard to reconcile everything in terms of the money, and there's a lot of pieces of software involved, and you've got to create listings on eBay and Amazon and all these sites, and you've got to support 20 different places, your own website, your email, Twitter, Facebook, on Amazon, on eBay, on everything. And so he was using multiple tools for multiple parts of his business. And we built a mega piece of enterprise software that solved practically all his problems, only to find, and I had done a deal on a handshake that I would own 15% of his business for the price of the software. I would write the software.
The old gem is back in the mix again,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, yeah. Well, something that's sort of different. And then when it came down to it, the VC kind of did me over, and I ended up stuck with this software, which I then said, well, fuck you, I'll go sell it. So I started to sell it. It was a huge piece of software, and then quickly realized I did not want to sell this software.
It was for managing e-commerce stores.
It was doing everything. It created your listings. It did your repricing. It did your support. It did like many, many, many things. And the problem was, every time we went to a new customer, they said they wanted something new. Right. And I thought, God, I'm just going to be writing software for everybody else for all that. So I just cut a few modules out of it.
Were you back writing the software?
No. I'm a product guy now. I don't get, they won't let me near it. We do joke. We have my best nights on the beer with the dev guys, and I tell them how they should have done it. And they laugh, and they're probably right. But no, I wasn't. But so we just cut 2 or 3 small bits out of the bigger product and started to sell them for cheaper money, and we will not change it for you. And so we end up in a business that probably, I don't know, I'd like to think it's worth 150 million. And then there's always the market and what markets pay. So
so what does it do? For anyone not familiar with eDesk, what exactly does it do?
Oh, it's pretty easy to describe now. I'm a great one for shortening how to describe things. We basically collect all of your support tickets from everywhere you sell and everywhere you support and put them into one place, one interface. And then we attach the order data. And so when someone writes to say, you know, when will my stuff arrive, the order information is right there beside them. I have to turn to another system and look it up and go, well, was that an Amazon order, an eBay order, whatever. And then what we did was we layered on AI to automate the answering. And so, so we collect all the tickets. We help you answer them. Simple as.
you built it, you were CEO, and then you stepped away. Why?
It was on a, it was on an insane trajectory. I had other things I wanted to do, and yeah, it was like, if you follow the graph to its logical conclusion in January 2020, it would be a $1 billion company right now, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, the graph was, everything was going right. We had poor cousins of ours in terms of competitors who were like way behind us functionality wise, and you know, when I came back, they were worth $800 million because we had not, we kind of missed the boat a little bit.
Why?
Because of some of stuff. First of all, COVID came, and I'm not maligning the people who ran it in the interim, but COVID came, so it's been learning how to do it, and they kind of spent a lot of time learning how to do it, and you know, maybe how we organized remote wasn't the best way it could have been done, and basically missed the tidal wave that was e-commerce.
It exploded in those years. You would have thought the two things would have went up simultaneously.
It's embarrassing to think that, you know, even that I was an owner or on the board, I was just, you know.
Were you screaming on the sidelines?
I wasn't the first time. We had an English CEO, and he couldn't travel. He couldn't travel during. He started, like, I mean, timing wise, you know, I left on Jan 20th, having waited 6 months for this guy to arrive. So, and then he arrives, and then COVID hits about a week later. So he was learning his new job in COVID. So it wasn't easy.
So what brought you back then? Why not hire another CEO?
I did, but we won't go there. When you see your company lose, we were losing 50 grand. The reason I actually came back was we were losing 50 grand a month in MRR. So we were not only not growing. And if you put that in context, you know, it's only 50 grand a month. It's 50 grand a month times 12, 600 grand a month a year in revenue opportunity times the then prevailing multiple. Losing 6 million in market cap every month when the last guy was in there. So it doesn't take... This is not a hard decision. I'm losing 6 million a month of market cap. So I went in and said, right, I'm starting on Monday. So I started Monday.
What did you go in with the mission to do? Obviously to stop losing money, but...
Yeah, well, I had to reverse out a lot of things. Again, if you're not an entrepreneur, or you run using a book, or think that it's just a process, you think... You know, you need, you know, we're not selling anything. Get more salespeople. Really? Why not? You know, we hire salespeople when the other people's, it's a bit of a joke. I go, we hire more salespeople when the existing salespeople's fingers are bleeding, typing in orders. Now, that's not the truth. But equally, if you've got two salespeople who are not succeeding, either your product's wrong or you're doing something wrong, you don't hire four more. And I went back in, there were 20 and we were losing money.
Wow.
So we lost that. And unfortunately, what then comes is I'm fixing the company. People who are mishired, and I look like the dog. But really what I'm doing, I'm saving this business. We had literally 20 months to live when I came back. At the pace we were losing business. So it was hard. Anyway, it was quite a challenge to get back. You know, and hey, it's great too. I'm a product guy, so being back, having the best dev team in the history of dev teams. You know, I've got a great team around me anyway, but because I'm a developer, you know, to see some of the stuff and at the pace we turned it over, I like I told you, we did AI early, like very early. But when I came back, so ChatGPT comes out and I write a paper on what we're going to do with ChatGPT on March the 7th. And on May the 7th, we released the single best piece of AI customer support, or possibly best AI software that I had seen. And still, it's outrageous what we do. I mean, in terms of taking bodies out of the game, it's, you know, we can automatically, with no touch, answer over 50% of the tickets that come into a support environment at e-commerce. And we're getting 400% improvement in productivity for the rest with AI hints. So it's outrageous. And the reason why we can do this is actually all the stuff we did up to then. It isn't that AI did it. We have the connectivity to Amazon, eBay, 200 marketplaces, Twitter, Facebook, Insta, TikTok, you know, so everywhere you support, we get all that ticket in.
Okay.
So, and we had already written our own AI 4 years previously under my tenure, which was, I was shocked at that it didn't really deliver. And I was going, why? Turns out we didn't train it on enough data. So then ChatGPT comes along, it's got trained on all the data. We get to leverage that. Obviously, we're all GDPR. We don't send any customer data to ChatGPT. We don't. We use the API, so they don't get to train it on what we send them, all that kind of stuff. So we're pretty conscious of that stuff too. But
So where does AI go then? Like, you've kind of hinted at the little improvements you've made. So broadly speaking,
you call them little improvements. Don't call them little. They are not little.
They're major improvements.
Monumental improvements.
Well, it sounds like it's happening again, right? It sounds like it's just happening again. You've found the sweet spot. You've found the market. The timing is correct. You sound energized, Ray.
I'm always energized when I talk about business that I'm in. I wouldn't get out of bed if I wasn't. So that's not surprising. This is an amazing time to be alive if you're a software guy or girl. It is just...
Why?
Because maybe it's finally... All this BS we've heard about computers will make life easy is going to come to reality. So it's not about not having to go to the post office with my letter and my stamp anymore. It's like, that's, you know, we're so far up from there. And now we can work really, really smart. You know, I mean, I had to put a job description out the other day, and I'm going, oh God, it's just, and it was a big job. So I'm thinking, I tried, to get someone to do it, and it really wasn't up there. And I could ChatGPT, I'm going to give me a job spec for this job. And it's like, I changed like five words. It was fantastic.
And phenomenal.
So I would encourage people, and like, people are afraid of AI, and people go, oh, it's going to take, well, forget that for a second. It's not going to take over the world. I just think that'll sort itself out. So don't go there. But what you should do is, every task that you have, you just say, like, pause and go, how can AI make this easier for me? How can ChatGPT make it easier? In fact, I think Google Bard is actually better for, in many cases, lately. How can I get a jump start in this task by going to ChatGPT first? And if it's a job spec, or give me the outline for a blog I want to write, or I've got to write an email to, you know, I've done things like for comedy. I have, in fact, if you're leaving our business and you've been around for a while, I recite a poem. I think they know that ChatGPT has written the poem.
Yeah, they're leaving now.
Yeah. And we write it, and we give some nuance to the job. We give it to ChatGPT, and I get a 14-line poem, and we all regale the person, and happy days.
I think AI is unbelievable for solving the blank page problem. Where do I start? I do it with the podcast. I'll feed your transcript back in. Yeah. I'll feed it into AI now. It'll give me the chapter summaries. It'll give me the main talking points. It'll give me things that are probably interesting for clips. It'll generate the clips for me. It's phenomenal. I think that's the thing that people are missing. It's not going to take people's jobs. It's going to make you 10 times more efficient if you learn how to use it.
I think we'd be lying if we said it's going to take people's jobs. It is. Hopefully, it's taking jobs that people don't want to do, or giving them the opportunity to do better jobs, or do stuff that's more fulfilling for themselves. It's going to do the mundane.
So what jobs does AI wipe out then?
Well, I think the content guys are going to have a bit of trouble, because even if you say, well, oh, it's AI and I can spot that it's AI written, you're still getting six times the productivity, even if you use it as a hinter to what you do. And so, I mean, that's sort of in my own space here. What else is it going to do? I've seen AI cleaning toilets. We have robo mowers. We have, you know, there's things that you do. You kind of go, anything that's repetitive. Like, you know, what's the funny thing is online travel. I get into cold sweats when I think about booking travel. I don't book my own travel anymore, but if I think about vacations, I end up getting involved, and it just blows my mind. I mean, why would I want to build this itinerary myself? Why does it not know that I always go to this kind of hotel? Why does it not know that I'm probably, if I'm a golfer, I want to go near that place, or I want to be near the city center. Why can't I type, and I can, into ChatGPT now with some of the add-ons, with Expedia or Booking.com add-ons, I can say, get me a weekend in Rome. I don't want to fly in the morning. I want to fly around noon, and I don't want to fly home after 5 p.m., and I'd like to be within 500 meters of Colosseum, and I'd like a nice Italian restaurant. And it should be able to fill that.
I love
that. That just takes some of the real pain out of it.
Giving us good insight there, Ray. I know we got to wrap up now after this. Going to do a quick fire round straight away.
Yeah.
What book would you recommend every entrepreneur must read?
So many and so much crap out there. The one that I keep giving people is Don't Make Me Think. It's, in fact, you almost don't have to buy it because there you go. There's a mantra. Live by it. Don't make me think. If your interface makes you think, then you failed.
It took me 12 clicks to pay for my parking this morning. I counted. It's ridiculous. Yeah. What's something you didn't pay enough attention to early on that you wish you had?
Nothing. I'm an attention to detail guy.
Nothing. Like confidence. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Sleep. I could have been a good rugby player, I believe. And I never fulfilled that. I was only okay, but I never made training. I played okay, but not enough. And I would like to have seen how that went.
What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
I'd give it back to you. And I'd spend an hour working out what charity you would give it to.
It's a cracker. What's something in your daily routine you wish you'd started sooner?
What in my daily routine?
What's one thing you do day to day that you wish you'd started sooner? A habit or routine you wish you'd done earlier in your life?
I don't know. I've recently seen positive writings about journaling and things like that, and just taking a little bit of time to go, I have achieved. So being me or being an entrepreneur, nobody ever says, well done. I mean, you can say, well done. Yeah. Someone say, well done, because you made 50 quid. Well, whoop-de-doo. But no one really ever, you've got to learn to say, look what I achieved. And sort of, because that's the only person who's really giving it to you.
Yeah, it's 100%. I think that's why a lot of people look for external validation in the wrong places, like fundraising.
Like money.
I'm going to give you 1 million euro to invest in one person or company. Who would you pick?
I hate to say it, I'm still all Apple. I've been Apple since about 10x ago. They have half a billion credit cards. That's what I really care about.
Yeah.
They have half a billion credit cards. They can put anything in front of you and you can just click it. Apple Pay, they're making 50 basis points on everything I tap.
It's phenomenal.
You know, yeah. And so it...
Don't Make Me Think, perfect example.
Yeah.
If you had to start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
I've had a couple of chats with people about this and maybe I'll do it. I think SaaS is insane, and as an opportunity, it's a great business model. But you know what? Everything I do is 99% the same as what Peter Coppinger does in Teamwork. The bit that we show on the screen is very small part of the business. So if there was a SaaS architecture where I gave you SaaS in a box, and I said, here's your billing system, here's your... here's everything you need to measure your marketing returns, to do your CRM and your God forbid, your support. And all you got to do is write the bit that matters to you, because most of us spend all our time doing everything else except the actual product that we're selling.
I like that. What do you believe that other people would strongly disagree with?
I believe people should go to an office, and I'll never retract that. I don't think they have to be in an office every day, but I think that work from home has more failings than good. And I think that it's okay for us old fuddy-duddies stuck in our offices with our careers kind of built, be the 21-year-old kid who's sitting in their bedroom on working off an ironing board, who isn't getting exposed to everybody else in the office and the opportunities, and maybe doing something different. To imagine Ray Nolan being pushed into an engineering job and never seeing what the people in marketing did or whatever else, wouldn't have ever achieved anything. And so you need to be exposed to people. I don't do meetings. I have one meeting in my diary every week. It's at about 2 o'clock on a Monday for an hour. I don't do meetings. I do bump into's. I do got 2 minutes. I do, there was a famous guy, I can't think of his name, HP management by walking around, MBWA. And it's just bump into people. How are you doing? Do you want a quick chat about that? Not the idea of an hour with too many people on the call or in the room where some people don't need to be there. And nobody gets to just freeform their conversation because the agenda is kind of set by the person who set the meeting. And it isn't about, you know, we don't end up finding out about a thing that happened in the US while we're talking about a nuance of a product over here. Mm. And so, yeah, they need to be, people need to get out. And for sure, there are people who don't need to be in the office every day. But there are people who do. And people who do need to acknowledge that if you're in marketing, you need to be in a creative environment surrounded by other people who are creative for most of the week, if not all of the week. If you're a developer, quiet is good, but you need to be part of a team, so you need to visit periodically.
What's one thing you spend money on in your personal life that brings you immense happiness?
I don't know. My favorite statement is, it's not the guy with the most toys that wins when the game is over. It's the people who've been to the most events. So I will go to an event if I can. I mean, I'm obviously the World Cup's on, right? I go there, but I mean, and I don't get to because I'm working. But yeah, don't think about embracing the time. And I don't take out my camera when I'm at a concert. I enjoy the concert if I'm at a concert. I don't go that many. But yeah, going to events and bringing people if I can.
Finally, what's your last piece of advice to any entrepreneur listening?
Understand the challenge ahead and make sure you really are up for it, because it's hairy. Look after your head, because thankfully that is a thing that is the fore now, which is right, because it is an immensely stressful thing, and you've got to find someone or some place where you can think out of these things. I don't. I'm a very closed. I solve my problems, but I wish I didn't. I wish it was a bit out there. And so find someone that you can spitball with and get stuff that feels like immense to go away, because there's no real, I heard a great statement today, which is, fear is a decision that you make, and you need to recognize this is, I've decided this is a fear. It's not really an issue. I can ignore it. It'll go away. I mean, the tiger might bite me, but who knows?
Ray, that was simply a phenomenal hour. Thank you so much. Where can people learn more about eDesk?
I hope we own .com. We definitely do. eDesk.com. It's a phenomenal product. I mean, if the ROI isn't there for you, then we failed.
Ray, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.